On Her Chest, The Star. Sarah Starzynski, a year younger than Zoe. I looked back at the list of names. I didn't need to ask Pont-Lévy where convoy number 15 leaving Beau-la-Hollande had gone. I knew it was Auschwitz. "What about the garage on the Rue de Bretagne?" I asked.
"That's where most of the Jews living in the third arrondissement were gathered before being taken to the Rue Nélaton and the Vélodrome."
I noticed that after Sarah's name, there was no mention of a convoy. I pointed this out to Pont-Lévy.
"That means she was not on any of the trains that left for Poland, as far as we know."
"Could she have escaped?" I said.
"It's hard to say. A handful of children did escape from Bon-la-Hollande and were saved by French farmers living nearby. Other children, who were much smaller than Sarah, were deported without their identities being clear. In that case, they were listed, for example, as one boy, Pithiviers. Alas, I can't tell you what happened to Sarah Starzynski, Miss Charmant. All I can tell you is that she apparently never arrived in Drancy with the other children from Bon-la-Hollande and Pithiviers. She is not in the Drancy files."
I looked down at the beautiful, innocent face. "What could have happened to her?" I murmured.
"The last trace of her we have is at Bon-la-Hollande. She may have been saved by a neighboring family. She could have remained hidden during the war under another name."
"Did that happen a lot?"
"Yes, it did. A great number of Jewish children survived, thanks to the help and generosity of French families or religious institutions."
I looked at him. "Do you think Sarah Starzynski was saved, that she survived?" He looked down at the photograph of the lovely, smiling child.
"I hope she was. But now you know what you wanted. You know who lived in your apartment."
"Yes," I said. "Yes, thank you. But I still wonder how my husband's family could live there after the Starzynski's arrest. I can't understand that."
"You must not judge them so harshly," warned Pont-Lévy. "There was indeed a considerable amount of Parisian indifference. But don't forget, Paris was occupied. People feared for their lives. Those were very different times."
As I left Pont-Lévy's office, I suddenly felt fragile, on the verge of tears. It had been a draining, taxing day. My world closed in around me, pressing down on me from every side. Bertrand, the baby, the impossible decision I was going to have to make, the talk I was going to have with my husband tonight, and then the mystery concerning the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment, the Tézac family moving in so quickly after the Starzynskis had been arrested, Mamet and Edouard not wanting to talk about it. Why? What had happened? What didn't they want me to know? As I walked toward the Rue Marbeuf, I felt like I was being swamped by something enormous, something I could not deal with. Later on that evening, I met Guillaume at the Select. We sat near the bar, away from the noisy terrasse. He had a couple of books with him. I was delighted. They were the exact ones I just could not get my hands on, particularly one concerning the Loiret camps. I thanked him warmly. I had not planned to say anything about what I had discovered that afternoon, but it all came tumbling out. Guillaume listened to every word intently. When I finished, he said that his grandmother had told him about Jewish apartments being plundered right after the roundup. Others had seals fixed on their doors by the police, seals that would be broken several months or years later when it was obvious that no one was coming back. According to Guillaume's grandmother, the police often worked closely with the concierge, who were able to find new tenants quickly by word of mouth. That's probably how it had happened for my in-laws.
"Why is this so important to you, Julia?" Guillaume asked finally.
I want to know what happened to that little girl. He looked at me with dark, searching eyes.
I understand. But be careful about questioning your husband's family.
I know they are holding something back. I want to know what it is.
Be careful, Julia, he repeated.
He smiled, but his eyes remained serious.
You're playing with Pandora's box. Sometimes it's better not to open it. Sometimes it's better not to know.
Franck Lévy had said the same thing that very morning. For 10 minutes, Jules and Genevieve had rushed about the house, like frantic animals, not speaking, wringing their hands. They seemed in agony. They tried to move Rachel, to carry her down the stairs, but she was too weak. They had finally kept her in bed. Jules did his best to calm Genevieve down, without much success. She kept collapsing on the nearest sofa or chair and bursting into tears. The girl trailed after them like a worried puppy. They wouldn't answer any of her questions. She noticed Jules glancing again and again toward the entrance, peering through the window at the gates. The girl felt fear pluck at her heart. At nightfall, Jules and Genevieve sat face to face in front of the fireplace. They appeared to have recovered. They seemed calm and composed. But the girl noticed Genevieve's hands trembling. They were both pale. They looked incessantly at the clock. At one point, Jules turned to the girl. He spoke quietly. He told her to go back down into the cellar. There were large bags of potatoes. She would have to climb into one of them and hide there as best she could. Did she understand? It was very important. If somebody went into the cellar, she would have to be invisible. The girl froze. She said,
"The Germans are coming."
Before Jules or Genevieve could say a word, the dog barked, making them all jump. Jules signaled to the girl, pointing to the trap door. She obeyed instantly, slipping into the dark, musty cellar. She couldn't see, but she managed to find the potato bags, toward the back, feeling the rough material with her palms. There were several large sacks of them, piled one on top of the other. Quickly, she pulled them apart with her fingers and slithered between them. As she did so, one of the bags split open, and potatoes came tumbling around her, noisily, in a series of quick thumps. She hastily layered them around and over her. Then she heard the steps, loud and rhythmic. She had heard those steps before, in Paris, late at night after the curfew. She knew what they meant. She had peered out of the window, and she had seen the men march by along the feebly lit street, with their round helmets and their precise movements. Men marching. Marching right up to the house. The steps of a dozen men. A man's voice, muffled but still clear, came to her ears. He was speaking German. The Germans were here. The Germans had come to get Rachel and her. She felt her bladder loosen. Footsteps just above her head. The mumble of a conversation she did not catch. Then Jules' voice.
"Yes, Lieutenant. There is a sick child here."
"A sick Aryan child, sir?" came the foreign guttural accent.
"A child that is ill, Lieutenant."
"Where is the child?"
"Upstairs."
Jules' voice, weary now. She heard the heavy steps rock the ceiling. Then Rachel's thin scream all the way from the top of the house. Rachel torn from the bed by the Germans. Rachel moaning, too feeble to fight back. The girl put her hands over her ears. She didn't want to hear. She could not hear. She felt protected by the sudden silence she had created. As she lay under the potatoes, she saw a dim ray of light pierce the darkness. Somebody had opened the trap door. Somebody was coming down the cellar stairs. She took her hands off her ears.
"There is no one down there," she heard Jules say. "The girl was alone. We found her in our dog shed."
The girl heard Genevieve blowing her nose. Then her voice, tearful, spent.
Please don't take the girl with you. She is too ill.
The guttural response was ironic.
Madame, the child is a Jew, probably escaped from one of the nearby camps. She has no reason to be in your house.
The girl watched the orange flicker of a flashlight creep along the stone cellar walls, edging closer. Then, aghast, she saw the oversized black shadow of a soldier cut out like a cartoon. He was coming for her. He was going to get her. She tried to make herself as small as possible. She stopped breathing. She felt as if her heart had stopped beating. No, he would not find her. It would be too hideously unfair, too horrible if he found her. They already had poor Rachel. Wasn't that enough? Where had they taken Rachel? Was she outside in a truck with the soldiers? Had she fainted? Where were they taking her, she wondered, to a hospital or back to the camp? These bloodthirsty monsters. Monsters! She hated them. She wished them all dead. The bastards. She used all the swear words she knew, all the words her mother had forbidden her ever to use. The dirty fucking bastards. She screamed the swear words in her mind, as loud as she could in her mind, closing her eyes tight, away from the orange spot of light coming closer, running over the top of the sacks where she was hiding. He would not find her. Never. Bastards. Dirty bastards.
Jules' voice again. There is no one down there, Lieutenant. The girl was alone. She could hardly stand. We had to look after her.
The lieutenant's voice droned down to the girl.
We are just checking. We are going to look around your cellar. Then you will follow us back to the commandanteur.
The girl tried not to move, not to sigh, not to breathe, as the flashlight roamed over her head.
Follow you? Jules' voice seemed stricken. But why?
A curt laugh.
Ha! A Jew in your house, and you ask why?
Then came Genevieve's voice, surprisingly calm. She sounded like she had stopped crying.
You saw we were not hiding her, Lieutenant. We were helping her get better, that's all. We didn't know her name. She could not speak.
Yes, continued Jules' voice. We even called a doctor. We weren't hiding her in the least.
There was a pause. The girl heard the lieutenant cough.
That is indeed what Guillaume told us. You were not hiding the girl. He did say that, the good Herr Doctor.
The girl felt potatoes being moved over her head. She remained as still as a statue, not breathing. Her nose tickled, and she longed to sneeze. She heard Genevieve's voice again, calm, bright, almost hard, a tone she had not heard Genevieve use.
Would you gentlemen care for some wine?
The potatoes stopped moving around her. Upstairs, the lieutenant guffawed.
Some wine, jawohl.
And some pâté, perhaps? Said Genevieve, with the same bright voice. Steps retreated up the stairs, and the trap door slammed shut. The girl felt faint with relief. She hugged herself, tears streaming down her face. How long did they remain up there? Glasses tinkling, feet shuffling, hearty laughs ringing out. It was endless. It seemed to her that the lieutenant's bellow was jollier and jollier. She even caught a greasy belch. Of Jules and Genevieve, she heard nothing. Were they still up there? What was going on? She longed to know, but she knew she had to stay where she was until Jules or Genevieve came to fetch her. Her limbs had gone stiff, but she dared not move. At last, the house was silent. The dog barked once, then no more. The girl listened. Had the Germans taken Jules and Genevieve with them? Was she all alone in the house? Then she heard the stifled sound of sobs. The trap door opened with a groan, and Jules' voice floated down to her.
Circa, circa!
When she came up again, her legs aching, her eyes red with dust and her cheeks wet and grimy, she saw that Genevieve had broken down, her face in her hands. Jules was trying to comfort her. The girl looked on, helpless. The old woman glanced up. Her face had aged, had caved in. It frightened the girl.
"That child," she whispered, "taken away to her death. I don't know where or how, but I know she will die. They wouldn't listen. We tried to make them drink, but they kept their heads clear. They let us be, but they took Rachel."
Genevieve's tears flowed down her wrinkled cheeks. She shook her head in despair, grasped Jules' hand, held it close.
"My God, what is our country coming to?"
Genevieve beckoned to the girl, clasped her small hand in her weathered old one. "They saved me," the girl kept thinking. "They saved me. They saved my life. Maybe somebody like them saved Michel, saved Papa and Maman. Maybe there is still hope."
"Oh, little Circa,"
sighed Genevieve, squeezing her fingers.
"You were so brave down there."
The girl smiled, a beautiful, courageous smile that touched the old couple right to their hearts.
"Please," she said, "don't call me Circa anymore. That's my baby name."
"What should we call you then?" asked Jules.
The girl squared her shoulders and lifted her chin.
"My name is Sarah Starzinski."
On my way from the apartment, where I had checked on the work in progress with Antoine, I stopped by the Rue de Bretagne. The garage was still there. And a plaque, too, reminding the passerby that Jewish families of the 3rd arrondissement had been gathered here the morning of July 16, 1942, before being taken to the Ville d'Eve and deported to the death camps. This is where Sarah's odyssey had started, I thought. Where had it ended? As I stood there, oblivious to the traffic, I felt I could almost see Sarah coming down the Rue de Saint-Ange on that hot July morning, with her mother and her father and the policeman. Yes, I could see it all. I could see them being pushed into the garage right here, where I now stood. I could see the sweet, heart-shaped face, the incomprehension, the fear, the straight hair caught back in a bow, the slanted turquoise eyes. Sarah Starzinski. Was she still alive? She would be 70 today, I thought. No, she couldn't be alive. She had disappeared off the face of the earth with the rest of the Ville d'Eve children. She had never come back from Auschwitz. She was a handful of dust. I left the Rue de Bretagne and went back to my car. In true American style, I had never been able to drive a stick shift. My car was a small automatic Japanese model that Bertrand scoffed at. I never used it to drive around Paris. The bus and the metro system were excellent. I felt I didn't need a car to get around the city. Bertrand scoffed at that, too. Bamber and I were to visit Bonne-la-Rolande that afternoon, an hour's drive from Paris. I had been to Drancy this morning with Guillaume. It was very close to Paris, wedged in between the gray, shabby suburbs of Bobigny and Pantin. Over 60 trains had left from Drancy, situated smack in the heart of the French rail system, to Poland during the war. I had not realized, until we walked past a large, modern sculpture commemorating the place, that the camp was obviously lived in now. Women strolled by with baby carriages and dogs. Children ran and shouted. Curtains blew in the breeze. Plants grew on windowsills. I was astounded. How could anyone live within these walls? I asked Guillaume if he knew of this. He nodded. I could tell by looking at his face that he was moved. His entire family had been deported from here. It was not easy for him to come to this place at all. But he had wanted to accompany me, he had insisted. The curator of the Drancy Memorial Museum was a middle-aged, tired-looking man called Manetsky. He was waiting for us outside the minute museum that was only opened if one telephoned and made an appointment. We wandered around the small, plain room, gazing at photographs, articles, maps. There were some yellow stars placed behind a glass panel. It was the first time I saw a real one. I felt impressed and sickened. The camp had barely changed in the last 60 years. The huge U-shaped concrete construction, built in the late 1930s as an innovative residential project and requisitioned in 1941 by the Vichy government for deporting Jews, now housed 400 families in tiny apartments and had been doing so since 1947. Drancy had the cheapest rents one could find in the vicinity. I asked the sad Monsieur Manetsky if the residents of the Cité de la Muette, the name of the place, which oddly enough meant City of the Mute, had any idea where they were living. He shook his head. Most of the people here were young. They didn't know, and they didn't care, according to him. I then asked if many visitors came to this memorial. School sent their classes, he replied, and sometimes tourists came. We leafed through the visitor's book. To Paulette, my mother, I love you and will never forget you. I will come here every year to think of you. This is where you left for Auschwitz in 1944 and never came back. Your daughter, Danielle. I felt tears prick the back of my eyes. We were then shown into the single cattle wagon that stood in the middle of the lawn, just outside the museum. It was locked, but the curator had the key. Guillaume helped me up, and we both stood in the small, bare space. I tried to imagine the wagon filled up with masses of people, squashed against each other. Small children, grandparents, middle-aged parents, adolescents, on their way to death. Guillaume's face had gone white. He told me later he had never been into the wagon. He had never dared. I asked him if he felt all right. He nodded, but I could tell how disturbed he was. As we walked away from the building, a stack of leaflets and books under my arm given to me by the curator, I could not help thinking of what I knew about Drancy. Its inhumanity during those years of terror. Endless trains of Jews shipped straight to Poland. I could not help thinking of the heart-wrenching descriptions I had read about the 4,000 Veldiv children arriving here at the end of summer of 42, parentless, stinking, sick, and ravenous. Had Sarah been with them after all? Had she left Drancy for Auschwitz, terrified and lonely in a cattle wagon full of strangers? Bamber was waiting for me in front of our office. He folded his lanky frame into the passenger seat after having put his photo gear in the back. Then he looked at me. I could tell he was worried. He put a gentle hand on my forearm. Julia, are you all right? The dark glasses didn't help, I guessed. My wretched night was written all over my face. The talk with Bertrand until the wee hours. The more he had talked, the more adamant he had become. No, he did not want this baby. It wasn't even a baby for him at this point. It wasn't even a human being. It was a little seed. It was nothing. He did not want it. He could not deal with it. It was too much for him. His voice had broken, to my stupefaction. His face had seemed ravaged, older. Where was my happy-go-lucky, cocksure, irreverent husband? I had stared at him in utter surprise. And if I decided to have it against his will, he had said hoarsely, that would be the end. The end of what? I had gazed at him, appalled. The end of us, he had said, with the awful, broken voice I did not recognize. The end of our marriage. We had remained silent, facing each other over the kitchen table. I had asked him why the birth of the baby terrified him to such an extent. He had turned away, had sighed, rubbing his eyes. He was getting old, he had said. He was approaching 50. That, in itself, was already hideous. Growing old. The pressure in his job to keep up with younger jackals, competing with them day after day, and then watching his looks fade. The face in the mirror he had such a hard time coming to terms with. I had never had this kind of talk with Bertrand before. I could never have fathomed aging had ever been such a problem for him.
"I don't want to be 70 when this child is 20," he muttered over and over again. "I can't, I won't, Julia. You have to get that into your head. If you have this child, it will kill me. Do you hear? It will kill me."
I took a deep breath. What could I tell Bamber? How could I ever begin? What could he understand? He was so young, so different. Yet I appreciated his sympathy, his concern. I squared my shoulders. "Well, I'm not going to hide it from you, Bamber," I said, not looking at him and clenching the steering wheel with all my might. "I've had a hell of a night."
"Your husband?" he asked tentatively.
"My husband, indeed," I quipped. He nodded. Then he turned to me.
"If you want to talk about it, Julia, I am here," he said, with the same grave and forceful tone Churchill had used to utter, "We shall never surrender."
I couldn't help smiling. "Thanks, Bamber. You rock." He grinned.
How is Drancy?"
I groaned. "Oh, god-awful. The most depressing place you've ever seen. People are living in the building, can you believe it? I went there with a friend whose family was deported from there. You're not going to have fun taking those Drancy photos, believe me. It's 10 times worse than the Rue Nélaton." I headed out of Paris, took the A6. Not that many people on the highway at this time of the day, thankfully. We drove in silence. I realized that I had to talk to someone, soon, about what was happening. About the baby. I couldn't go on keeping it to myself. Sharla. Too early to call her. It was barely 6 a.m. in New York City, although her workday as a tough, successful lawyer was about to start. She had 2 small children who were the spitting image of her ex-husband, Ben. And there now was a new husband, Barry, who was charming and into computers. But I did not know him well yet. I yearned to hear Charla's voice. The soft, warm way she said, "Hey!" on the phone when she knew it was me. Charla had never gotten along with Bertrand. They more or less put up with each other. It had been that way since the start. I knew what he thought of her. Beautiful, brilliant, arrogant, American feminist. And Charla concerning him. Chauvinistic, gorgeous, vain frog. I missed Charla. Her spirit, her laugh, her honesty. When I had left Boston for Paris all those years ago, she was still in her teens. I had not missed her much in the beginning. She was just my kid sister. It was now that I did. I missed her like hell. Came Bamber's soft voice. "Wasn't that our exit?" It was. "Shit," I said. "Never mind," said Bamber, fumbling with the map. "The next one's okay, too." "Sorry," I mumbled. "I'm a little tired." He smiled in sympathy and kept his mouth shut. I liked that about Bamber. Bonne-la-Rolande drew near, a dreary little town lost in the middle of wheat fields. We parked in the center by the church and the town hall. We walked around, Bamber taking an occasional photo. There were few people, I noticed. It was a sad, empty place. I had read that the camp was situated in the northeast section, and that a technical school had been built over it in the 60s. The camp used to be a couple of miles away from the station, exactly on the opposite side, which meant that the deported families had to walk through the heart of the town. "There must be people here who remembered," I said to Bamber. "People who saw the endless groups trudge by from their windows, their doorsteps." The train station was no longer in use. It had been renovated and transformed into a daycare center. There was something ironic about that, I thought. peering through the windows at colorful drawings and stuffed animals. A group of small children were playing in a fenced-in area on the right of the building. A woman in her late 20s, carrying a toddler in her arms, came out to ask me if I needed anything. I replied that I was a journalist, researching information about the old internment camp that used to be here in the 40s. She had never heard of a camp in the area. I pointed to the sign nailed up just over the daycare center door. In memory of the thousands of Jewish children, women, and men who between May 1941 and August 1943 passed through this station and the internment camp at Beaune-la-Hollande before being deported to Auschwitz, the extermination camp, where they were assassinated. Never forget. She shrugged, smiling at me apologetically. She didn't know. She was too young anyway. This had happened long before her day. I asked her if people ever came to the station to look at the sign. She replied she hadn't noticed anyone since she started working there last year. Bamber clicked away as I walked around the squat white building. The name of the town was etched out in black letters on either side of the station. I peered over the fence. The old rails were grown over with weeds and grass, but still in place, with their ancient wooden planks and rusty steel. On those derelict rails, several trains had left directly for Auschwitz. I felt my heart tighten as I gazed at the planks. It was hard to breathe all of a sudden. Convoy number 15 of August 5, 1942, had carried Sarah Starzynski's parents straight to their deaths.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Sarah's Key by Tatiana Deronay. Read for you by Polly Stone. Sarah slept badly that night. She kept hearing Rachel scream over and over again. Where was Rachel now? Was she all right? Was somebody looking after her, helping her get well again? Where had all those Jewish families been taken? And her mother, and her father, and the children back in the camp at Beaune-la-Hollande? Sarah lay on her back in the bed and listened to the silence of the old house. So many questions, and no answers. Her father used to answer all her queries. Why the sky was blue, and what were clouds made of, and how babies came into the world. Why the sea had tides, and how flowers grew, and why people fell in love. He had always taken time to answer her, patiently, calmly, with clear, easy words and gestures. He had never told her he was too busy. He loved her incessant questions. He used to say she was such a bright little girl. But recently, her father had not answered her questions the way he used to, she recalled. Her questions about the yellow star, about not being able to go to the cinema, the public swimming pool, about the curfew, about that man in Germany who hated Jews and whose very name made her shiver. No, he had not answered her questions properly. He had remained vague, silent. And when she had asked him again, for the second or the third time, just before the men had come to get them on that Black Thursday, What was it exactly about being a Jew that made others hate them? Surely it couldn't be that they were afraid of Jews because Jews were different. He had looked away, as if he hadn't heard. But she knew that he had. She didn't want to think about her father. It hurt too much. She couldn't even remember the last time she saw him. At the camp? But when exactly? She didn't know. With her mother, there had been that last time she had seen her mother's face turn to her, as she had walked away with the other sobbing women up that long, dusty road to the station. She had a clear image pasted in her mind, like a photograph. Her mother's pale face, the startling blue of her eyes, the ghost of a smile. But there had been no last time with her father, no last image she could cling to, she could conjure. So she tried to remember him, to bring back his thin, dark face, his haunted eyes, the white teeth in the dark face. She had always heard she looked like her mother, and so did Michelle. They had her fair Slavic looks, the high, broad cheekbones, the slanted eyes. Her father used to complain that none of his children resembled him. She mentally pushed her father's smile away. It was too painful, too deep. Tomorrow, she had to get to Paris. She had to get home. She had to find out what had happened to Michelle. Maybe he was safe too, like she was now. Maybe some good, generous people had been able to open up the door of the hiding place and free him. But who, she wondered, who could have helped him? She had never trusted Madame Royer, the concierge. Sly eyes, thin smile. No, not her. Maybe the nice violin teacher, the one who had yelled out on that black Thursday morning, "Where are you taking them? They're honest, good people. You can't do this." Yes, maybe he had been able to save Michelle. Maybe Michelle was safe in the man's home, and the man was playing Polish tunes to him on his violin. Michelle's laugh, his pink cheeks, Michelle clapping his hands and dancing round and round. Maybe Michelle was waiting for her. Maybe he said to the violin teacher every morning, "Is Circa coming today? When is Circa coming? She promised she would come back and get me. She promised." When she was awoken at dawn by the call of a rooster, she realized her pillow was wet, sodden with her tears. She dressed quickly, slipping into the clothes that Genevieve had laid out for her. Clean, sturdy, old-fashioned boy clothes. She wondered who they belonged to. That Nicolas Dufort who had painstakingly written his name out in all those books? She put the key and the money into her pocket. Downstairs, the large, cool kitchen was empty. It was early still. The cat slept on, curled up in a chair. The girl nibbled on a soft loaf of bread, drank some milk. She kept feeling in her pocket for the wad of money and the key, making sure they were safe. It was a hot, gray morning. There would be violent storms tonight, she knew. Those loud, frightening storms that used to scare Michelle so. She wondered how she was going to get to the station. Was Orléans far? She had no idea. How was she going to manage? How would she find her way? "I got this far," she kept saying. "I got this far, so I can't give up now. I'll find my way. I'll find a way." And she couldn't leave without saying goodbye to Jules and Genevieve. So she waited, throwing crumbs to the hens and chicks from the doorstep. Genevieve came down half an hour later. Her face still carried the traces of last night's crisis. A few minutes later, Jules appeared, planting an affectionate kiss on Sarah's crew cut. The girl watched them prepare breakfast, with slow, careful gestures. She had grown fond of them, she thought. More than fond of them. How was she going to tell them she was leaving today? They would be heartbroken, she was sure of that. But she had no choice. She had to get back to Paris. When she did tell them, they had finished breakfast and were clearing up.
"Oh, but you can't do that," gasped the old lady,
nearly dropping the cup she was drying.
The roads are patrolled. The trains are watched. You don't even have an identity card. You'll be stopped and sent back to the camp.
I have money, said Sarah.
But that won't prevent the Germans from...
Jules interrupted his wife with an uplifted hand. He tried to convince Sarah to stay a little longer. He spoke to her calmly and firmly, like her father used to, she thought. She listened, nodding her head absently. But she had to make them understand. How could she explain her need to get home? How could she remain as calm and as firm as Jules? Her words came out rushed and jumbled. She was fed up with trying to be adult. She stamped her foot in irritation.
If you try and stop me, she said darkly. If you stop me, I'll run away.
She stood up, headed to the door. They hadn't moved. They were staring at her, petrified.
Wait, said Jules at last. Wait 1 minute.
No, I am not waiting. I am going to the station, said Sarah, her hand on the handle.
You don't even know where the station is, Jules said.
I'll find out. I'll find my way.
She unlatched the door.
Goodbye,
she said to the old couple.
Goodbye, and thank you.
She turned and walked to the gates. It had been simple. It had been easy. But as she walked past the gates, bending to stroke the dog's head, she suddenly realized what she had done. She was on her own now. Completely on her own. She remembered Rachel's shrill scream. The loud, marching steps. The lieutenant's chilling laugh. Her courage petered out. Against her will, she turned her head, looked back at the house. Jules and Genevieve were still watching her through the window pane, frozen. When they both moved, it was exactly at the same time. Jules grabbed his cap and Genevieve her purse. They hurried outside, locked the front door. When they caught up with her, Jules put a hand on her shoulder.
Please don't stop me, mumbled Sarah, reddening.
She was both happy and annoyed that they had followed her.
Stop you? Jules smiled. We're not stopping you, you silly, stubborn girl. We're coming with you.
We made our way to the cemetery under a hot, dry sun. I felt queasy all of a sudden. I had to stop and breathe. Bamber was concerned. I told him not to worry, it was just lack of sleep. Once again, he looked dubious, but made no comment. The graveyard was small, but we took a long time finding anything. We had nearly given up when Bamber noticed pebbles on one of the graves, a Jewish tradition. We came closer. On the flat white stone, we read, The Jewish deported veterans had this monument established 10 years after their internment, in order to perpetuate the memory of their martyrs, victims of Hitlerian barbarity, May 1941 to May 1951.
Hitlerian barbarity, remarked Bamber dryly. Makes the French sound like they didn't have anything to do with the whole business.
There were several names and dates on the side of the tombstone. I leaned forward for a closer look. Children. Barely 2 or 3 years old. Children who had died at the camp in July and August 1942. Valdiv children. I had always been acutely aware that everything I had read about the roundup was true. And yet, on that hot spring day, as I stood looking at the grave, it hit me. The whole reality of it hit me. And I knew that I would no longer rest, no longer be at peace, until I found out precisely what had become of Sarah Starzynski, and what the Tezak knew and were so reluctant to tell me. On our way back to the town center, we saw an old man shuffling along, carrying a bag of vegetables. He must have been in his 80s, with a round, red face and white hair. I asked him if he knew where the former Jewish camp used to be. He looked at us suspiciously.
The camp?
He asked.
You want to know where the camp was?
We nodded.
Nobody asks about the camp,
he mumbled. He picked at the leeks in his basket, avoiding our eyes.
Do you know where it was? I persisted.
He coughed.
Of course I do. Lived here all my life. When I was a kid, I didn't know what that camp was. Nobody mentioned it. We acted as if it wasn't there. We knew it had something to do with Jews, but we didn't ask. We were too afraid. So we minded our own business.
Do you remember anything specific about the camp? I asked.
I was about 15 years old, he said. I remember the summer of 42, crowds of Jews coming from the station, passing on this very street, right here.
His crooked finger pointed down the large street we were standing on.
Avenue de la Guerre. Hordes of Jews. And one day, there was a noise. An awful noise. My parents used to live at a distance from the camp. But we still heard it. A roar that went through the entire town. Went on all day. I heard my parents talking to the neighbors. They were saying that the mothers had been separated from the children back at the camp. What for? We didn't know. I saw a group of Jewish women walking to the station. No, they weren't walking. They were stumbling along the road, crying, bullied by the police.
His eyes looked back down the street, remembering. Then he picked up his basket with a grunt.
One day, he said, the camp was empty. I thought, the Jews have gone. I didn't know where. I stopped thinking about it. We all have. We don't talk about it. We don't want to remember. Some people here don't even know.
He turned and walked away. I scribbled it all down, feeling my stomach heave again. But this time I wasn't sure whether it was morning sickness or what I deciphered in the old man's eyes. His indifference, his scorn. We drove up the Rue Rolande from the Place du Marché and parked in front of the school. Bamber pointed out that the street was called Rue des Déportés, Deportee Road. I was thankful for that. I don't think I could have stood it if it had been called Avenue de la République. The technical school was a grim, modern building, with an old water tower looming over it. It was difficult to imagine the camp had been here, under thick cement and parking lots. Students were standing around the entrance, smoking. It was their lunch break. On an unkempt square of grass in front of the school, we noticed strange, curving sculptures with figures carved into them. On one of them, we read, "They must act with and for each other, in a spirit of fraternity." Nothing more. Bamber and I looked at each other, puzzled. I asked one of the students if the sculptures had anything to do with the camp. He asked, "What camp?" A fellow student tittered. I explained the nature of the camp. It seemed to sober him up a little. Then the other student, a girl, said there was some sort of plaque just a little farther down the road, heading back to the village. We hadn't noticed it on our drive up. I asked the girl if it was a memorial. She said she thought so. The monument was in black marble with faded gold lettering. It had been erected in 1965 by the mayor of Bonne-la-Rolande. A gold star of David was etched out on its summit, and there were names. Endless names. I picked out two names that had become painfully, achingly familiar. Starzinski, Vladislav. Starzinski, Rivka. On the bottom of the marble post, I noticed a small, square urn. Here are deposited the ashes of our martyrs from Auschwitz-Birkenau. A little farther up, beneath the list of names, I read another sentence. To the 3,500 Jewish children torn from their parents, interned at Beau-la-Rolande and Pithiviers, deported and exterminated at Auschwitz. Then Bamber read out loud, with his polished British accent, "Victims of the Nazis, buried at the graveyard of Bonne-la-Rolande."
Below, we discovered the same names engraved on the tomb in the cemetery. The Veldiv children who had died in the camp.
Victims of the Nazis again, muttered Bamber. Looks like a good case of amnesia to me.
He and I stood and looked on, in silence. Bamber had taken a few photographs, but now his camera was back in its case. On the black marble, there was no mention that the French police alone had been responsible for running the camp and for what had happened behind the barbed wire. I looked back toward the village, the sinister, dark spire of the church on my left. Sarah Starzinski had toiled up that very road. She had walked past where I was standing now, and she had turned left, into the camp. Several days later, her parents had come out again, to be taken to the station, on to their deaths. The children had been left alone for weeks, then sent to Drancy, and then to their solitary deaths, after the long trip to Poland. What had happened to Sarah? Had she died here? There had been no sign of her name in the graveyard on the memorial. Had she escaped? I looked beyond the water tower, standing at the edge of the village, heading north. Was she still alive? My cell phone rang, making us both jump. It was my sister, Sharla.
Are you okay?
She asked, her voice surprisingly clear. It sounded like she was standing right next to me, and not thousands of miles away across the Atlantic.
I had a feeling I should call you.
My thoughts dragged away from Sarah Starzinski to the baby I was carrying, to what Bertrand had said last night. The end of us. Once again, I felt the sheer heaviness of the world around me. The train station at Orléans was a busy, noisy place, an anthill swarming with gray uniforms. Sarah pressed against the old couple. She did not want to show her fear. If she had made it all the way here, that meant there was hope left for her. Hope back in Paris. She had to be brave. She had to be strong.
If anybody asks, whispered Jules, as they waited in the line to buy the tickets to Paris. You are our granddaughter, Stephanie Dufour. Your hair is shaved off because you caught lice at school.
Genevieve straightened Sarah's collar.
There, she said, smiling. You do look nice and clean and pretty, just like our granddaughter.
Do you really have a granddaughter? Asked Sarah. Are these her clothes? Genevieve laughed.
We have nothing but turbulent grandsons, Gaspard and Nicolas, and a son, Alain. He's in his 40s. He lives in Orléans with Henriette, his wife. Those are Nicolas's clothes. He's a little older than you. Quite a handful he is.
Sarah admired the way the old couple pretended to be at ease, smiling at her, acting like this was a perfectly normal morning, a perfectly normal trip to Paris. But she noticed the quick way their eyes darted around constantly, always on the watch, always on the move. Her nervousness increased when she saw soldiers checking on all passengers boarding the trains. She craned her neck to observe them. German? No, French. French soldiers. She had no identification on her. Nothing. Nothing except the key and the money. Silently, discreetly, she handed the thick wad of bills to Jules. He looked down at her, surprised. She pointed with her chin toward the soldiers barring the access to the trains.
What do you want me to do with this, Sarah?
He whispered, puzzled.
They are going to ask you for my identity card. I don't have one. This might help.
Jules observed the line of men standing in front of the train. He grew flustered. Genevieve gave him a dig with her elbow.
Jules, she hissed. It could work. We must try. We don't have any other choice.
The old man drew himself up. He nodded to his wife. He seemed to have regained his composure. The tickets were bought. Then they headed toward the train. The platform was packed. Passengers pressed against them from all sides,
women with squealing babies, stern-faced old men, impatient businessmen wearing suits. Sarah knew what she had to do. She remembered the boy who got away at the indoor stadium, the one who had slipped through the confusion. That was what she had to do now. Make the most of the pushing and squabbling, of the soldier shouting orders, of the bustling crowd. She let go of Jules' hand and ducked. It was like going underwater, she thought. A tight, compact mass of skirts and trousers, shoes and ankles. She clambered past, pushing herself on with her fists, and then the train appeared, right in front of her. As she climbed on, a hand grabbed her by the shoulder. She composed her face instantly, molding her mouth into an easy smile. The smile of a normal little girl. A normal little girl taking the train to Paris. A normal little girl like the one in the lilac dress, the one she had seen on the platform when they had been taken to the camp on that day that seemed so long ago.
"I'm with my granny,"
she said, flashing the innocent smile, pointing to the inside of the carriage. With a nod, the soldier let her go. Breathless, she squirmed her way onto the train, peering out of the window. Her heart was pounding. There were Jules and Genevieve emerging from the throng, looking up at her with amazement. She waved at them triumphantly. She felt proud of herself. She had gotten on the train all by herself, and the soldiers hadn't even stopped her. Her smile vanished when she saw the number of German officers boarding the train. Their voices were loud and brutal as they made their way through the crowded corridor. People averted their faces, looked down, made themselves as small as possible. Sarah stood in a corner of the carriage, half hidden by Jules and Genevieve. The only part that was visible was her face, peeping out between the old couple's shoulders. She watched the Germans draw nearer, gazed at them, fascinated. She couldn't keep her eyes off them. Jules whispered at her to look away, but she couldn't. There was one man in particular that repelled her. Tall, thin, his face white and angular. His eyes were such a pale shade of blue they seemed transparent under thick pink lids. As the group of officers passed them by, the tall, thin man reached out with an endless, gray-swathed arm and tweaked Sarah's ear. She shivered with shock.
"Well, boy," chuckled the officer. "No need to be afraid of me. One day you too will be a soldier, right?"
Jules and Genevieve had painted, fixed smiles that did not waver on their faces. They held on to Sarah casually, but she could feel their hands trembling.
"Nice-looking grandson you have there."
The officer grinned, rubbing his immense palm over Sarah's cropped head.
"Blue eyes, blonde hair, like the children back home, yes?"
A last appraising flicker of the pale, heavy-lidded eyes. Then he turned and followed the group of men. "He thought I was a boy," thought Sarah, "and he didn't think I was Jewish." Was being Jewish something that one could immediately see? She wasn't sure. She had once asked Armel. Armel had said she didn't look Jewish because of her blonde hair, her blue eyes. "So my hair and my eyes have saved me today," she thought. She spent most of the trip nestling close to the old couple's warm softness. Nobody spoke to them. Nobody asked them anything. Staring out of the window, she thought of Paris edging nearer by the minute, bringing her closer to Michelle. She watched the low gray clouds gather together, the first fat drops of rain splatter against the glass, and trickle away, flattened by the wind. The train stopped at the Austerlitz station, the station she had left from with her parents on that hot, dusty day. The girl followed the old couple out of the train, heading up the platform to the metro. Jules' step faltered. They looked up. Directly ahead, they saw lines of policemen in their navy uniforms, stopping passengers, demanding identity cards. Genevieve said nothing, gently pushed them on. She walked at a firm pace, her round chin held high. Jules followed in her wake, clasping Sarah's hand. Standing in the line, Sarah studied the policeman's face. A man in his 40s, wearing a wedding band, a thick gold one. He looked listless, but she noticed that his eyes darted back and forth from the paper in his hand to the person standing in front of him. He was doing his job thoroughly. Sarah let her mind go blank. She didn't want to think of what might happen. She did not feel strong enough to visualize it. She let her thoughts stray. She thought of the cat they used to have, a cat that made her sneeze. What was the cat's name? She couldn't remember. Something silly like Bonbon or Réglisse. They gave it away because it made her nose tickle and her eyes go red and swollen. She had been sad, and Michelle had cried all day. Michelle had said it was all her fault. The man held out a blasé palm. Jules handed him the identity cards in an envelope. The man looked down, shuffled through it, eyes shooting up at Jules, then at Genevieve. Then he said,
"The child?"
Jules pointed to the cards.
"The child's card is there, monsieur, with ours."
The man opened the envelope wider with a deft thumb. A large banknote folded into three appeared at the bottom of the envelope. The man did not budge. He looked down again at the money, then at Sarah's face. She looked back at him. She did not cower or plead. She simply looked at him. The moment seemed to drag on, endless, like that interminable minute when the man had finally let her go from the camp. The man gave a curt nod. He handed the cards back to Jules and pocketed the envelope with a fluid gesture. Then he stood aside to let them pass.
"Thank you, monsieur," he said. "Next person, please."
Charla's voice echoed into my ear.
"Julia, are you serious? He can't have said that. He can't put you in that situation. He has no right."
It was the lawyer's voice I was hearing now, the tough, pushy Manhattan lawyer who wasn't afraid of anything or anyone. "He did say that," I replied, listless. "He said it would be the end of us. He said he would leave me if I kept the baby. He says he feels old, that he can't deal with another child, that he just doesn't want to be an old dad." There was a pause.
"Does this have anything to do with the woman he had the affair with?" asked Charla. "I can't remember her name."
"No, Bertrand did not mention her once."
"Don't let him pressure you into anything, Julia. This is your child, too. Don't ever forget that, honey."
All day long, my sister's sentence had echoed within me. "This is your child, too." I had spoken to my doctor. She had not been surprised at Bertrand's decision. She had suggested that maybe he was going through a midlife crisis, that the responsibility of another child was too much for him to bear, that he was fragile. It happened to many men coming up to 50. Was Bertrand really going through a crisis? If that was the case, I had not seen it coming. How was that possible? I simply thought he was being selfish, that he was thinking of himself as usual. I had told him that during our talk. I had told him everything that was on my mind. How could he impose abortion after the numerous miscarriages I had gone through, after the pain, the crushed hope, the despair? Did he love me? I had asked, desperate. Did he truly love me? He had looked at me, nodding his head. Of course he loved me. How could I be so stupid? He had said. He loved me. And his broken voice came back to me, the stilted way he had admitted his fear of growing old. A midlife crisis. Maybe the doctor was right after all. And maybe I hadn't realized it because I had so many things on my mind in the past few months. I felt totally lost, incapable of dealing with Bertrand and his anxiety. My doctor had informed me that I did not have much time to make my mind up.
I was already 6 weeks pregnant, and if I was to abort, I would have to do it within the next 2 weeks. Tests had to be done. A clinic had to be found. She suggested we talk about it, Bertrand and I, with a marriage counselor. We had to discuss it. We had to bring it out into the open.
If you abort against your will, my doctor had pointed out, you will never forgive him. And if you don't, he has admitted to you how much this is an intolerable situation for him. This all needs to be worked out, and fast.
She was right. But I could not bring myself to speed things up. Every minute I earned was 60 seconds more for this child. A child I already loved. It wasn't even bigger than a lima bean, and I loved it as much as I loved Zoe. I went to Isabelle's place. She lived in a small, colorful duplex on the Rue de Tolbiac. I felt I just couldn't come home from the office and wait for my husband's return. I couldn't face it. I called Elsa, the babysitter, and asked her to take over. Isabelle made me some crottin de chavignol toasts and threw together a quick, delicate salad. Her husband was away on a business trip.
Okay, cocotte, she said, sitting in front of me and smoking away from me.